Good evening and welcome behind the news for October 3, 2002. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at the time, at the worlds of economics and politics. We've got one interview scheduled for tonight, and then we'll take some phone calls at the bottom of the hour. But the interview will take up most of the first half hour, and that is with Linda Pino, who is an MD, who spent some time as the person who denied care to sick people for a several managed care entities, and she'll tell us what that was all about. And she was the subject of a movie that was shown on Showtime, commissioned by and shown on Showtime, the cable TV channel, in the spring. Not many of us have movies made about our work. She did, and she'll tell us about her work and the movie and what we might be able to do about HMOs. And then, since there's so much in the news these days, we've got impending war, lingering recession, political illegitimacy all over, we'll take some phone calls and hear from you and see what develops a little after 5:30. Before we get to the Linda Pino interview, a couple of items. First of all, yes, that recession does still linger. There are some fairly bright economic indicators coming out now and then, but the preponderance of them, at least for the U.S. economy, have been towards weakness over the last few weeks, especially on the job market. This morning it was reported that the number of applications for first-time unemployment insurance rose, and that's been rising now for several weeks. This is not what should be happening in a normal economic recovery, we should be seeing quite the opposite. We should be seeing very rapid job growth and a very steep decline in the number of people filing for unemployment insurance. Also, the number of people continuing to draw unemployment insurance continues to rise. And only about half the officially unemployed, or slightly less actually, are drawing unemployment benefits now. So it's the job market is not good, and that is not what is supposed to be happening right now. And it doesn't really help that our president wants to take us into a war, which, besides killing lots of people and imposing imperial and illegitimate authority on folks outside our borders, it would also be extremely disruptive economically, has great potential, but to be very disruptive economically and could be extremely expensive. The president's chief economic advisor, Larry Lindsey, said a couple of weeks ago that it would cost $100 to $200 billion, which is 2 to 4 times as much as the estimates the Pentagon had been using. So we're talking very, very big numbers, even by the standards of the U.S. government. It seems like George Bush and his cronies want to rule the world, and the rest of the world isn't too happy with it. But when the United States wants to do something, it's kind of hard to stop it. So maybe we can talk about all that in the phone calls at the second part of the show. Lots and lots of things to worry about economically and politically and militarily these days. In a feature of most weeks on the show, the most ridiculous item of the week, something lifted from the tremendously amusing and often vile Bill O'Reilly and his O'Reilly Factor on Fox News. The most ridiculous item of the week came in today, an AP report. Candidate turned himself blue. Montana's Libertarian candidate for Senate has turned blue from drinking a silver solution that he believed would protect him from disease. Stan Jones, a 63-year-old business consultant and part-time college instructor, said he started taking colloidal silver in 1999 for fear that Y2K disruptions might lead to a shortage of antibiotics. He made his own concoction by electrically charging a couple of silver wires in a glass of water. His skin began turning blue-gray a year ago. People ask me if it's permanent or if I'm dead. He said, I tell them I'm practicing for Halloween. He does not take the supplement any longer, but the skin condition, called urgeria, is permanent, although it's generally not serious. The AP adds, colloidal silver dietary supplements are marketed widely as an antibacterial agent or immune system booster, but some consider it quackery. And the fact that this guy is a libertarian and a lunatic, I think, should make us think that some alternative health practices are associated with some very strange politics, and that may not make me popular in some quarters around here, but I think somebody should bring up the question, what's this all about? Maybe it's appropriate for libertarians and individualists, but it's a strange form of social criticism. On the other hand, that doesn't mean that the medical establishment is something to be celebrated either, as we'll hear from the next interview, which I recorded earlier today with Linda Pino. She is an MD. She calls herself an HMO gadfly. More officially, she's now a consultant of healthcare systems and ethics, specializing in managed care. She's based in Louisville, Kentucky, and she'll be speaking in a couple of weeks to a meeting of the Physicians for a National Health Program on Saturday, October 19th, exact time and place to be announced. So if you're interested in that, you can call PNHP's New York chapter, 212-666-4001, or visit their website, pnhpnyc.org. Linda Pino. So let's listen to that interview, and it goes on about 25 minutes, so see you at the bottom of the hour.
Welcome to WBAI, Linda Pino. You are an MD, but with a history of sort of managerial history as well. Can you tell us a little bit about, give us a little resume of your career?
I started in the early 80s doing reviews at a hospital, actually reviewing cases where the hospital suddenly had to figure out how to manage patients and keep them within their payment system. So that was a whole new experience as a physician to be telling other physicians how to care for their patients. But out of that, I ended up going to an insurance company that's based here in Louisville, Humana, and was there as the medical reviewer for a little less than a year. And in that capacity, it was my job to approve or deny admissions to the hospital. And
now, was that very case-by-case or just a very broad kind of coverage?
No, it was case-by-case. So when a physician wanted to admit a patient to the hospital, the physician would have to call and go through a layer of nurses and then ultimately a company doctor, and the company doctor, which was the role that I played, would tell the patient whether or not they could be admitted to the hospital. So we made the determination without ever seeing the patient, knowing very little about the patient's history, and a lot based on some rules that we had within the company.
And what were these rules like? I mean, they're mainly financial rules, or are they medical rules, or a combination of the two?
A combination. Some medical rules. I mean, this whole language has developed, the concept of making medical necessity determinations, for example, where a company doctor examines a request and determines whether something's medically necessary. So we would have criteria, usually very stringent criteria, because our goal was to limit as many admissions as possible.
Well, was there a working presumption against admission?
Right. We wanted to limit and deny as much as possible because that's the only way you can save money.
And a generation ago, this would have been entirely up to the physician.
Right. A physician would never have to go through another layer of physicians, particularly physicians who had, no hands-on care of the patient.
Okay, so could you give an example of the kind of case you'd have to decide on?
Well, everything that had to be admitted to the hospital would come under our review, but it could be something like, for example, somebody wanted to, one case, a surgeon wanted to admit a man, he was an elderly man who had been losing weight and had several other symptoms that were highly suggestive of cancer. They just hadn't been able to find out where the cancer was, and they wanted to do what's called an exploratory surgery of the abdomen. And we denied that admission because our rules said that you couldn't do that kind of you couldn't admit for that kind of surgery. At a more serious end of the scale, a case that I've written about and spoken about frequently involved the denial of a heart transplant for a patient because we ultimately figured out that there was a clause in his contract that enabled us to deny it. So that would be an example of a non-medical rule that we would use in order to figure out how to deny care.
So this just was a way out to save money, and it really probably had a very bad impact on this person's life and health.
Oh, absolutely. And as one of my physician supervisors told me very soon into my job, is that I was there to give medical validation to the company's economic decisions. So, we did make the decisions. I mean, we would start out, the process that I would go through would be to review every case from the perspective of how can I deny this.
So if somebody is bleeding from the head, you couldn't very well deny admission. But other than that, the presumption was to say no wherever possible?
Right, and you know, even it's interesting you used the example you did because there was another physician I worked with who had sort of learned to figure out the game because we were tracked according to our percent of denials, and he actually denied admission to a patient who came in a cardiac arrest in a particular hospital because he sort of felt like the patient was already, you know, dead or wasn't going to live or whatever. Later when I came on, the doctor called me back, and I was the one who got stuck with approving, you know, a case that would never have even been questioned, you know, a year or so prior to that. So even in extreme, clear-cut emergencies, we were kind of expected to sort of figure out if there were other things that we could do, especially when we were being tracked according to our percent of denials.
So that was how you were graded as an employee, and whether you get promotions or retained or all those things, and you're just a percentage of denials?
Well, at that point, it was a very primitive system when I left that company, and then when I went to the next HMO as a medical director, actually the executive physician over all kinds of things, then I was graded on, it was a little more sophisticated. It wasn't just my denial rate, but it was a more sophisticated way of looking at savings and how I was managing the cases to the benefit of the company. So it wasn't just pure denials, but it involved all kinds of other things. But essentially, yes, that's the definition. It was the definition of a good medical director or a good company doctor.
So you went from Humana to where?
To an HMO. It was owned by three hospitals in our community as a competitor to Humana. But we were managed by a national HMO company, and I was there for 2 years and then merged into Blue Cross and was of Kentucky and was there for a year.
So is it more of the same there?
Yes, basically. I had thought by going to a nonprofit HMO and then eventually to Blue Cross that the philosophy would be different and the way we would treat patients would be different. But, you know, ultimately I think what I discovered and what led me to leave entirely was this sense that the only way you made money in the managed care industry was by limiting and denying care. And the processes for doing that were virtually the same whether you were in a for-profit or a non-profit entity. So essentially I ended up doing the same things and having lots of negative experiences as a physician in this other setting.
So at the non-profits, presumably they're under a different set of incentives. So how did they incorporate this ethic of care denial? Was it competition or was there some sort of spreading culture? What was the mechanism?
Well, it's interesting. There's a great scene in this movie that Showtime did in the spring about my work where the CEO of the non-profit HMO where I am comes up to me and is talking about, you know, some plans are beginning to give bonuses, and my response is, well, but it's nonprofit. And he says, well, but just because the company is nonprofit doesn't mean that we as individuals can't benefit. So I mean, obviously the most basic thing is that if a nonprofit organization doesn't succeed, then everybody loses their job. So there's the whole culture gets created of you've got to be financially solvent, and the way you do that is by limiting and denying care. And then, depending on the particular organization, you can have individual bonuses that are directly tied into some medical management parameters. And so, you know, it ends up reflecting the same thing that occurs in a for-profit setting. It's just that you don't call it profits. It's something else.
You said your experience with some of those subsequent plans after Humana was they were more sophisticated. Could you describe some of the components of the algorithms that went into admitting or denying?
Well, I think it was more sophisticated in that the whole industry was becoming more sophisticated. So, for example, when criteria were developed in order to use that to deny care, the criteria became more sophisticated, and then it became computerized. And over the past decade, you know, companies have sprung up to assist HMOs in developing the tightest criteria possibly and therefore extracting the most denials. It became more sophisticated in terms of the contracts you set up with physicians in order to get the physicians to comply more with the managed care practices.
Are the doctors given bonuses are paid according to economic measures now?
Yes, and that's something that's become quite sophisticated because, you know, particularly with plans that have arrangements that's referred to as capitation, and that's a relationship in which a plan pays a physician a fixed amount of money every month for every person assigned to that physician's panel of care. So if you're a primary care physician with 2,000 patients that have listed you as their gatekeeper, then you get, it runs about anywhere from $100 to $150 a year. You get that much money for each patient that's on your panel. And then if you, on one level, if you don't spend that money, you keep what's left. So obviously if all 2,000 of those patients are 18-year-old young men who will never open your door in your office, you keep all that money. But if you have, you know, 56 patients, you can spend it all in a month. And then there are other bonuses that are used on top of that, where if you meet certain targets as a physician or a medical group, you get some percent of the savings that you've generated back.
Are patients aware of these things?
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, I think they get bits and pieces, but when, you know, when somebody on a television news program does a story about a particular patient that's experienced something adverse in the managed care or an HMO, there's not enough time, but they never get to the whole system, you know, how the system as a whole is organized, and, you know, all the way from, you know, setting up company nurses and doctors to sophisticated payment arrangements with physicians, you know, the clauses in the contract, the coverage benefits. I mean, all that together, nobody ever really gets that picture. And then so little is really disclosed to the consumer. I mean, there's nothing in your you see all the positive advertising, but you don't see anything that tells you the negative ways that a particular plan is going to be affecting your care.
Now, are the doctors told not to talk about this? Is this part of their contract?
Well, there was a big issue in the mid-90s because plans were actually putting in clauses in the contracts that prohibited doctors from saying negative things about the plans. And so some of those overt clauses were taken out of contracts. I have seen more subtle ways that plans do that with physicians. But generally, you know, the physicians know that if they talk negatively about a plan, that they run the risk of not being recontracted or losing their panel of patients or whatever. So it's the whole culture set up in which you get people to behave in a certain way.
Now, doctors are sworn under an oath to take care of people. The whole professional validation of being a physician is to heal the sick. How do they reconcile that? How do the doctors feel about these economic constraints they're under?
Well, I think that you know, many physicians find the conflicts of interest that have been created just almost untenable, which is you see a lot of physicians leaving the practice of medicine entirely. I think the thing that's saddest for me is seeing young physicians come in. They go into medical school. They're all excited. They love medicine. They go through training, and then they go out into the world of practice and to see what happens to them when, you know, within just a few years of practice. Some physicians, you know, become very adept at playing the system, you know, and so they sort of lose the sense of Hippocratic oath and, you know, somewhat for survival. I mean, you know, a physician's like anyone else. I mean, you have bills to pay and house payments and kids in school, and so I see a lot of physicians beginning to become very complicit in the whole system just in order to be able to survive. And I think that's sad. But to some extent, the whole healthcare system is one in which physicians often don't have the chance to build real strong relationships with individual patients. And so when you just have a flood of patients coming through, you know, you don't have the conditions in which you build up these human bonds that I think overcome the tendencies to give in to some of the financial pressures.
Well, this must be quite a shock for a profession that used to be very self-governing. Doctors really controlled an awful lot of the whole process. Now they're really being turned into very heavily scrutinized, highly paid, but still heavily scrutinized and controlled employees. What's this doing to the profession?
Well, I think it's turned the profession less of a profession and more as just a trade group, really, and many physicians feel like that. And I think, unfortunately, over time, we will begin to select out those people who just view medicine as a job. And you know, when you think of the distinction, sometimes, I mean, what constitutes a profession is, at least for me, it's being called into doing something, you know, whether it's ministry or medicine or law or, you know, some socially responsible area of work that you would do no matter how much you got paid. So I think that it has changed the profession and it will continue to change the profession.
Not many of us have movies made about their work, but you did. Could you tell us a bit about your star turn on Showtime?
Well, it was interesting because the whole thing started because I wrote this article for U.S. News and World Report about trying to describe the culture of what it was like to be a doctor working under these kinds of circumstances. And that turned out to be so difficult because of legal issues related to, you know, just whether or not we could publish the article, that at first when Showtime called me, they actually called in response to that article, I didn't even want to talk to them because it cost me three times what I got paid for the U.S. News and World Report article to pay attorney fees. But then the people at Showtime, as I got involved with it, were just wonderful. And they really did want to make a good, balanced movie about the system, which is, you know, in contrast to what I just mentioned a few minutes ago, where you just get bits and pieces in the evening news. And they worked on the project with such integrity. And even though, you know, I had reservations about sort of putting my private life into public view, I feel like ultimately it was worth it because the end product, I think, really does give a sense of a realistic picture of where healthcare has come to. And it doesn't end with answers. I mean, it ends with a sense that we all have to think about these situations deeply, and we all have some role to play and how we resolve this for the present and the future.
And what was the storyline of the movie?
Well, the storyline was based on this article that I wrote where it was when I was at the second HMO. A young nurse had a stroke, and she needed a special piece of equipment to help her speak. And, of course, that was just a total taboo because it was expensive, and I was told it was a creature comfort, the fact that one had to speak. And
speaking was a creature comfort.
Right. And at this point, I had gotten so disgusted with things that were going on that I went through all kinds of hoops and had decided I was going to prove it because we didn't have any reason to contractually deny it, which set a whole bunch of other things in motion. So the theme of the movie is really underpinned by this nurse and what happened and my approval of the voice machine. And what's really interesting is that as a result of making the movie, I actually ended up making contact with the nurse, which, of course, you know, that's the other horrible thing. As a company doctor, you make all these tragic decisions, and you never have to confront the patient. And so she and I are good friends now, and that's been healing for me, you know, to be able to connect with her and to share the movie with her. We bought her rights to her story, And so that's been very rewarding. But then the movie sort of tracks about 13 years of starting at Humana and then ending up with the congressional testimony.
Now, all this is supposed to control costs. I mean, it's supposed to improve the profitability of the healthcare corporation, but it's also supposed to control the costs of healthcare. And it doesn't seem to be doing a very good job. And we had a little slowdown in medical inflation in the mid-90s, but now we're seeing, you know, just incredible increases in health insurance premiums. Why is this not really having, I mean, this kind of denial of care, you'd think would at least control costs, but it's not. Why is it not?
That's a very interesting question, and a very important question because, you know, initially when sort of the managed care machinery started was in formation and getting geared up. I mean, it's very expensive for a company to hire nurses, set up the computer equipment, hire company doctors, and to, you know, set up the machine that, that reviews and limits and, you know, comes up with decisions and all of that. And initially, that machine was really effective because it's like other people have written, we probably saw the one-time savings from managed care, and we'll never see those things again because, you know, managed care came in and said, okay, we're no longer going to pay for admissions before the night of surgery. We're going to reduce newborn stays or postpartum stays to 24 hours. You know, all those sorts of things that we've seen them crack down on. We'll never, you know, there will never be a chance to achieve those kinds of savings again. But what's happened then is that we've created this huge machinery. And what I think we're finding out now is that we can't afford the business of healthcare and healthcare, and we're going to have to deal with that. And yet the business, this huge machinery, is still churning away, trying in every way possible to keep squeezing dollars out. And the analogy that I like to use is that it's like a huge funnel with a series of filters, and you pour the premium dollars in at the top, and then a few cents trickle out at the bottom, and that's what goes to healthcare or to patient care. And then in the middle, in all these filters, are all these sophisticated ways that the industry is trying to keep as much of the premium dollars as possible. And they even refer to that. Anything that's paid out in patient care is a medical loss. And so that from a business perspective, they view it as a loss.
There's studies you see now and then that say there's no difference in the quality of care or outcomes between for-profit and non-profit entities. Do you buy that, though? What's producing these results?
Well, I look at so many of these studies all the time, and I think, you know, part of it is that we haven't, I don't think we've done the full extent of the kinds of studies and the depth of studies that need to be done in order to demonstrate that. The other thing is that I see from legal cases that I work on is that, and this becomes a critical issue for the public and policymakers, is that so much of the information is controlled and remains secretively guarded by the health industry, so that there's no way, even if you're doing an academic study, there's no way to really get at what really goes on in a health plan, to really examine the results of decisions and their practices. They either hide behind, you know, the fact that they claim that things are proprietary or peer review, but there's just no way to sort of open up that black box. And so I view all the studies with a kind of critical eye to the fact that I think that, you know, we just don't have enough complete information. And then until we have a totally transparent healthcare system, we're not going to be able to see the kinds of things that we really need to see.
Well, and corporate structures don't coexist very well with transparency.
No.
What do you see as the way out of this dilemma?
Oh, gosh. That's a part of the movie that always makes me sad when I watch it, is that there aren't any answers or that it wasn't solved. But, you know, I think right away the one thing that we have to do is we have to get rid of the legal protection that health plans have through this federal law called ERISA. Because right now everybody who gets their health care through their employer, the managed care plan or HMO, is protected legally from certain kinds of lawsuits that can hold them accountable when they adversely affect patient care. So if we did away with that right away, I think we'd see some changes in practice, because health plans would know that they would be accountable for the systems they set up and the decisions they made. And I'm not pro-litigation, I'm just pro-accountability, and I think, unfortunately, in the corporate world, maybe that's the only way you get it. Second, I think we've got to be careful that we don't throw away the baby with the bathwater, because I think whatever health system we have needs to have some sort of management. I mean, we can't have an unmanaged healthcare system. It's just that we've got to manage it for the benefit of patients, not for the benefit of profits. So, you know, I kind of imagine, you know, some way to retool all these systems and that have been set up and these processes that have been devised, but focus them on, you know, make them patient-centered rather than profit-centered. And then I think we've got to have, you know, universal health care. And that's the only way we're to have some sort of universal system where we will see that when we do have legitimate savings by managing care appropriately, those savings get folded back into health care. They don't get, you know, siphoned off into shareholders or expensive buildings and executive salaries and all these non-health care aspects of, you know, the way we see where the money's going. There's a particular scene in the movie that I think is so powerful because right after the heart transplant, I saw a piece of skull, which I thought at the time cost $500,000, which would have been about the cost of the heart transplant. I later found out after the movie aired that that piece of sculpture cost $3.8 million. So when we talk about allocation of resources, you know, I think it's an interesting exercise to think how much health care $3.8 million would have provided. And I suspect that a considerable number of the denials I made wouldn't have had to have been denied if we'd been focused on spending that money appropriately.
Well, that's the magic of the marketplace at work. Thanks for joining us, Linda Pino.
Okay, thank you, Doug.
And that was Linda Pino, who self-identified HMO Gadfly, a healthcare consultant and ethics specialist, who was a former medical director for a number of managed care companies, describing her experiences denying people care. And we'll be back to take some phone calls, 212-209-2900, 212-209-2900, after this little musical interlude from Paul Van Dyke and Valio. Valio, I think, was the voice, and remixed by the DJ, Paul Van Dyke. And we have a full board here. So, oh, I should say it's behind the news. My name is Doug Henwood, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. So let's got a bunch of people waiting, so let's take a call. Welcome to WBAI. You're on the air. Oop, no, you're not. Let's try this one. Welcome to WBAI.
Yes, WBAI. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm fine. I've had a lot of questions, but several things I'd like to speak about is my son was injured by a vaccine, and we've been trying to get some physical therapy for him, and he needs physical therapy about twice a week. And the HMO said he can have physical therapy for 60 days straight, but that's not what the child really needs. He needs it like twice a week for the
whole
year.
I really can't help you with this, so I don't know what... By calling, I don't know what you're hoping to get. Cause
well, HMOs set up a system whereby you can get physical therapy. Well, my question is, the criteria that HMOs have set up is where you can get physical therapy for 30 days straight, but if you need it over a whole year and you need it like twice a week, they say that's not what the health plan will provide. They'll provide it for you for 30 days in a row, but they won't break it up insofar as if you need it like twice a week.
Well, I understand you have a problem, but I can't. I don't know what I can tell you to do. I mean,
I'm not asking for a answer. I'm just stating a fact.
Well, you know, there are millions of people in your position that you know, they can't. This is a system that's designed to deny care and to screw people. And
yeah, well, I agree.
Yeah. So, short of well, I don't think even a lawyer can help if given the insulation that these guys have from lawsuits. So, I don't know. We need this needs to be made into a political issue, but nobody's really doing it right now.
Well, I know something going to the Supreme Court in New Jersey about it, but it has to do with the fact that you're not allowed to sue a vaccine company if you didn't sue within 36 months. It's the shortest limit, statute of limitations on record. Usually it's 7 years. You're only given 36 months to sue them, so I understand the premise that has been set forth by the industry. And even the judge's decision was, if we keep suing these pharmaceutical companies, they'll all go out of business, which is fine with me. But that was the judge's decision in May of 2001.
Well, we've got a full board here, so
Go.
Thanks for your call. Please, let's take another one here. Welcome to WBAI. Hello?
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I have a question about stock.
Yeah, sure.
What if you had, like, mutual stock funds with your employer 401k? Would you hold on to it right now, or would you sell it and go into something really low interest, like 3%?
Wow. I'm not paid enough to give investment advice, I don't think. Let me just lay out what I think is going on. I think we're in the midst of a very long period of financial distress and declining stock prices. So you may have taken a big hit now, but there may be an awful lot more to come. So if you can, I wouldn't have any money in the stock market right now, but like I say, I'm not paid enough to give financial advice, so good luck. Thank you. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yes. I was listening to the doctor, and I just want to remind listeners that part of the reason this has happened was our wonderful senator from New York, Hillary Clinton, and her husband helped create this, at least partially helped create this mess. So the next time she runs for something, maybe someone should bring that up.
Well, that's a very good point, because...
And we all seem to forget these things, and we go into the booth in a sense of denial, and then we vote for these idiots again.
Well, even worse than that, I've seen people writing letters to Hillary asking for her help on this issue, and, you know, she's the last person you'd expect. I mean,
no, she screwed us royally. How could
yes,
help us?
In two ways. I mean, one is that, you know, when she and her husband unleashed that abomination in the world, it ended... healthcare is a political issue for years,
right?
And sort of discredited the whole single payer moment. But even worse than that, she is now, according to people who talk to her or are around her, she's
mm-hmm.
thinking of running for president in 2008.
Right, exactly.
And she wants to position herself as far right as possible.
That's clear. Yeah.
So she's not the person to turn to on this.
She should run for senate from some other state than New York. I mean, we've become right wing, but we're not that far right wing.
Well, it's just amazing what people will delude themselves about Hillary. Like, she's some secret liberal. I think she's actually to the right of her husband on a lot of issues.
I'm sure she is. She was a Republican before she was a Democrat.
So, yeah. That's
That's
a good reminder that Hillary is just not worth the hill of beans.
I would also like to bring up, maybe listeners could respond. I'm a retired teacher, and I was just, like, laughing and shocked at the same time that my union, which I don't think of as a union anymore, the UFT has decided to support that idiot Pataki, who is destroying our economy in New York State. I would like to hear other listeners, if they want, to say something about that.
Yeah, that is strange. I mean, all these unions are endorsing Pataki.
Isn't it amazing? What are they getting paid? Well, we know what the teachers got. They got a raise.
Yeah, well, I think it's mostly very narrow business union kind of concerns that are causing
and
these guys.
And they're going to lose a lot of jobs come January when... If he wins, the budget is corrected, because the budget as presented, it can't fly.
No. I mean, this state and most states around the country have severe budgetary
sure.
problems because of a bad economy. And
sure.
They generally wait to cut the budget till the election is over. And
right.
people fall for it every time.
Yep.
But unfortunately, Carl McCall's letter writing has gotten him in a lot of trouble, too. So
sure.
It's not a very happy prospect we face.
No, not at all.
All right, well, thanks for your call. We've got a bunch of other people in line here, so let's talk about it. WBAI, you're on the air. Hello?
Oh, yes. How are you doing?
How are you?
The reason why unions are probably endorsing is because it's not the membership that's endorsing Pataki. It's usually just the leadership. And the leadership will sell the union members down the drain in a heartbeat.
Okay. Well, thanks for your comment. Let's see if any other union people out there have any comments on their union's political behavior or whatever else is on people's minds. We have another one. Welcome to WBAI.
Yes. First of all, I would suggest you have an open phone segment of this kind. Let's say the first Thursday of every month, because we need to converse with you more often, I think. Secondly, about 13 years ago, a famous economist gave a lecture at the New York Open Center in which he posed the question, can capitalism survive without a gold standard? And unfortunately, I was unable to attend the lecture given by this noted economist, so I'd like to know what the current opinions are on this subject, especially in light of the various bailouts over the past decade and the various financial crises.
Who is that famous economist?
You.
Oh, did I do that?
Yes.
No, that was a long time ago. I can't remember what I was saying. Can capitalism survive with a gold standard, I think, is a more relevant question. It's just a very, very punishing thing. I think the central bankers of the world seem to, at least for the moment, have devised a system that's rigid, that balances rigidity and flexibility enough so that they can maintain a pretty austere standard most of the time and then run the necessary bailout when they have to. They've managed to keep the first world out of depression. The third world has been in and out of depression for much of the last 20 years, but the first world has avoided that, and I don't know. Can capitalism survive another 100 years, 200 years? I certainly hope not, but the effects on the earth of another 100 years of this sort of thing is probably just more than we or the earth can handle. So.
Well, one more thing, and that is at the top of your show, you began by trashing a certain persons in the alternative medicine field. Let me suggest to you the existence of a book published by called Native Cures, by Oxford University Press, published recently, which I think gives a fairly fair and balanced approach of the alternative medicine ideology versus conventional medicine ideology over the years, and how one has become the other, and the other has become one, and so forth.
Well, that sounds very interesting. An old friend of mine thought he was going to write a book, half of which was criticizing alternative medicine and half of which was criticizing orthodox medicine. And he realized that he'd have no audience for that because either people just wanted to hear one thing or the other and didn't want to hear critical analysis of both of those things.
Native Cures, Oxford University Press.
All right. Well, thank you. I'll check it out.
Okay.
Let's take another call. WBAI, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, hi. Yeah. Doug, I think the segment that you just gave us about a half hour ago with this doctor was very valuable because living here in New Jersey, I mean, the Star Ledger and the Times occasionally does articles on this issue, but for some reason seem to be afraid to stay away from it. I've had experience with hospitals and medical care here in New Jersey. It's obvious that the system has deteriorated drastically. But the main question I called, and it's a brief one, I think, is just to get your feedback on something. Since getting a PC, have delved around the web a lot about different radical and socialist websites. One that's been of interest to me lately is the World Socialist website, which seems to be headquartered in Australia, and this is the Fourth International. Some of their articles, their theoretical articles by this Nick Beams, seem to be well written, and some of their daily news summaries seem to be valuable. I do have some reservations about them. The tone is kind of smug. Just wondering what your feedback is on this. Do you think there's that these people are too dogmatic in their approach to politics, or do you have any reaction at all?
Well, I think the World Socialist website, I can't remember, it's WSWS.org. Is
right,
their,
that's
their,
it, yeah.
Their address, yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of good stuff on there. There's some intelligent analysis, thoughtful stuff, but they also are the latest manifestation of an old, small, sectarian Trotskyist party that exemplifies all the deformities of that particular point of view, which is sectarianism and certain narrow-mindedness and stubbornness. But like I say, there's an awful lot of good stuff in there, too. You can learn a lot by reading highly opinionated people that you don't necessarily agree with. Another print version of that sort of thing is the newspaper The Spartacist League. The Spartacist League is another one of these small Trotskyist sects who behave very disruptively and annoyingly at a lot of mass meetings, but on the other hand, they produce a very, very good newspaper, Workers' Vanguard, which is almost it's like $3 a year or something. It's practically free, but if you find one, they're always for sale on the street, so if you happen to come across one, pick it up. It's actually a pretty good paper. There is a tradition of intellectual rigor and thoughtfulness and independence among those sorts of parties that occasionally produces some good analysis. So, like I say, the World Socialist website does some good stuff, and Workers' Vanguard does some good stuff if you ignore all the boilerplate parts of it.
Oh, thanks a lot, and thanks again for that first segment today. Very
valuable.
You're
welcome.
Sure, yeah.
And before I take a call, I should say that I hope everyone, I'm sure you're going to hear a lot about this over the next few days and probably hear a lot about it already, but everyone, I urge everyone to go to the anti-war demonstration, Not in Our Name, sponsoring on Sunday in Central Park. It's Sunday from 1 to 5 p.m. On the East Meadow at 97th Street and 5th Avenue at Central Park. They were 250,000 people in London last weekend demonstrating against the war. It's even more our war than theirs, and we're a much bigger country. We should be able to produce lots of people. It'd be nice if we could produce something like 250,000 here in New York City. So, again, please turn out there Sunday, 1 to 5 p.m., East Meadow, Central Park, 97th Street and 5th Avenue, Not in Our Name. And now let's take another call.
Hello.
Welcome to WBAI.
Hello. Yes, Doug. We keep talking about these characters that want to get reelected. I don't know what's like the old expression, throw the bums out. There are a number of parties. My party, the Green Party, I think hits the nail right on the head. In other words, the corporations control the politicians. We know of campaign financing, and that's all I'm saying. It's just the fact that people got to wake up and realize if the corporations control a large number of the representatives, senators, congressmen, then the corporations are behind it all. Okay.
All right, well.
All right.
You got a point. Sounds like you're calling from a highway medium, though. Welcome to WBAI. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. How you doing? I just want to make a couple of comments. One about unions. They're not all the same. Some are controlled by a leadership that sells out the rank and file, and some have rank and file that are very conservative and right-wing.
That's a good point, because in a lot of cases, the rank and file will vote to the right of the leadership.
That's right. I've been in a lot of them, and that's what my experience has been. The medical thing, I mean, I've had a lot of problems with doctors in New York, and I don't have enough time to say what it's been, but I think, I don't know if this will be a solution, but somehow we have to have more average people knowledgeable about medical practices, and we have to become our own doctors, because and I don't see any other way, because I haven't been able to get, I've had to use Medicaid and many times, and I've not really gotten anything done, gone to the hospital and done nothing. So I'm not saying it's all bad, but I have had quite a few incidences. And,
One of the many admirable things about ACT UP during its heyday was that those people really understood the disease and understood the drugs and really mastered the medicine of that was involved and were capable of analyzing, but also lobbying and pressuring. But was really a great model. It would be great to see that sort of thing happen in other areas, so that you know, everyone, not everyone has the time to become his or her own doctor, so it'd be really great to have, you know, advocacy groups that know what they're talking about and know to analyze and pressure.
No, you know, you're right. I think there has to be, or society has to be reorganized so that more people can practice medicine instead of the economy being preoccupied with producing things that are really worthless and time-consuming, and people shouldn't be, wasting their time producing things that are just for the market and just junk, basically. And their time should be devoted more to things that, we need to have more people doing.
Well, amen to that. Thank you for your call. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to know if the government finally decides to stimulate the economy to get us out of the recession, what prevents private corporations from simply raising their prices instead of supplying more goods and services?
Well, right now it's very, very hard for corporations to raise prices. There's a lot of complaint in the business press and even on even Alan Greenspan himself that businesses lack pricing power. And you know, in an inflationary time, you know, you don't want to see rising prices, but we're really on the brink of a deflation right now, falling prices, which are very, very dangerous. If you get into a deflation like that, it can lead to a completely out of control depression. So a little stimulus and a little bit in the way of higher prices is probably much better, much less risky right now than would be the opposite, because we don't want to end up like Japan has been in the last 10 years or what the United States was like in the 1930s. Deflations are very painful and ugly things and hard to get out of. So I think rising prices is the least of our worries right now.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. WBAI, you're on the air. WBAI, you're on the air. Oh. All right, is this one here? Hello?
Hello?
Welcome to WBAI. Speak.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Handler.
Yes.
Yes, I do share the same. Good afternoon. I do share the sentiments of the caller two or three callers back. I thought it was some very valuable information. I also have a daughter who is in the healthcare profession, and she's so sick to her stomach, she's just about getting ready to get out of it, you know. And I also have other friends who are members of the healthcare profession. They've had it up to their necks with it. But anyhow, I'd just like to ask one more thing of you. I'd like to know how I can get a copy of that program, of this program.
A copy of this program? Well, if you have access to the World Wide Web, I'm putting all these shows up now on a website so you can listen to it.
Okay.
Unfortunately, I'm a little behind. I don't have last week's show up yet, but I'm going to put that show and today's show up probably sometime tomorrow. So,
okay.
So you can visit www.leftbusinessobserver. That's all one word, leftbusinessobserver.com. And right there on the front page, there's a link to the radio archive, and you can listen to this show and quite a few others. I've got about 8 or 9 full shows up there now and quite a few individual interviews, including Michael Hart, Judith Levine, and Gore Vidal. So relive great moments of behind the news in the past.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very interesting.
Thank you. www.leftbusinessobserver.com, and look for the radio archive. It's right there on the front page. And I think we're just about out of time, so better bring it to a close here. Thank you for all your calls, and hope to do that again soon. A couple of programming notes. October 17, two things. I'll be here for the special. For the fundraiser from 3 to 6, a special on George Bush's newest world order. We're going to the plans that have been that Dick Cheney and his gang of right-wing cronies have been hatching for years now to redraw the whole map of the Middle East and to assert American imperial power without any kind of challenge from anywhere. We'll look at that from many angles. And again, that's 2 weeks from today, from 3 to 6 p.m. And that evening, at the Brecht Forum, 122 West 27th Street, I will be moderating a panel on socially responsible business. Is there such a thing? Is there such a thing as progressive or socialist entrepreneurship? And again, that's 2 weeks from tonight, 7:30 p.m. at the Brecht Forum, 122 West 127th Street. So that's it for me. I won't be here next week, but I will be here 2 weeks from now. And stay tuned for the news and on to the evening. And let's go out with a little bit more of Paul Van Dyke and Valia. Thank you.